It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Things are a little different this summer, but it's still a great time to explore, learn, and have fun. And every Tuesday, all summer long, you can come to Talk of Iowa Summer Camp. Last week, the subject was rock and roll. But remember, we would never have gotten to rock and roll without the original popular music, what we now call classical music. Our camp counselor for today is Tim Hankowich, better known as the director of Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Charity. Great to be with you.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. And of course, this hour, you are going to guide us through the world of classical music, or at least a little corner of it.
You're going Well, it's certainly something near and dear to my heart.
All right. Let's start with a very basic question, Tim. What
sure.
is classical music?
That is surprisingly a very difficult question to answer, because that phrase or the word classic or classical can mean so many different things broadly or specifically, and depending on the context of the conversation, it could be a very confusing term.
All right, and so we have to help us with our definition, we have
sure.
a song to play that
right?
that could definitely be defined as a classic song.
Right. The thing is, I find in the most general point of view, anything that is classic or classical is something that is created that defines the time it comes from, and yet is so good and is admired afterwards throughout time, so it actually transcends the time from which it was created.
All right, well, here's an example of something that definitely does that.
Okay. Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song. Start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made.
All right, I could listen to that all day, Tim, but of course that is the Beatles with Hey Jude. It fits all of the things that you described just before we played it, but I don't think most of us would actually define that as classical music.
Right. People are probably scratching their head. Okay, Hankowich has finally lost it. But the thing is, like a classic car, whether it's like a 1970 Ford Mustang or 1969 Corvette Stingray, these are great accomplishments that define its time and yet can still turn our heads today. So I'm old, but I'm not that old. This music by the Beatles predates me, but so many people today recognize this music because it has survived beyond its generation, and every generation has their music, and over time, the cream of the crop rises to the top and becomes classic. And so that's what gets us into this broader term. What is classical music? And I think when you're normally just talking to everybody on the street, classical music seems to be more like a catch-all phrase. Anything that means something written for acoustic instruments, piano, or let's say a violin, or strings, brass, percussion, woodwinds. But here's the biggest distinction. It is usually written down by a composer for a variety of acoustic instruments that is intended for other ensembles to play. And I think that is sort of the most general catch-all phrase of what classical music really means.
All right, so the fact that it is put on paper and you can give that paper to another musician and they can play it. But
right.
There have to be exceptions to all of the rules that you just gave
us. Oh, yeah. So many people will also think that classical music means something old, because if you were to go by that definition, classical music is still being written today, yesterday, tomorrow, and the day after, if all it needs to be is written down. So that is sort of the most broadest sense. And that's why the whole phrase classic and classical music can be so confusing for people just starting to get into this kind of music.
When we talk about classical music, at least for most of us, when we think of it, we do start thinking about things that are pretty old. So when
right.
did what we call classical music, when did that first start happening?
Well, again, before we get too specific, because historically it does, it sort of connotates a particular time in history. But in the grand thing of classical music, that you would consider classical when you turn on the radio or whatever medium that you listen to music on, you're basically talking about music that was written as early as, 1650, all the way up to today.
All right, so it's been around for a very long time.
It's been around for a very, very long time. Yeah, our hits last a very long time.
The golden oldies. All
right,
let's listen to a golden oldie here, at least a little bit of it. This is Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, part of the first movement. Let's listen. All right, just a little bit of the first movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. And I think he had talent, like the Beatles.
Yeah, he's going to be okay, I think. Yeah. You know, arguably, that's the most, people hear that, okay, finally, that is what classical music is. Well, wait, not so fast, because it can actually be even more specific than that. But, you know, here's a piece that was written by a composer, written for acoustic instruments like violins or strings or brass percussion, and intended for other people to play. And so you would think this would be classical music. But, you know, this piece is so famous for so many reasons. I think this is one of the pieces that everybody almost recognizes, like Hey Jude would be recognized today.
Right, absolutely. It's something that everyone has heard, whether they know it or not, because it's been used in so many places.
Right.
It's been in a movie that you have watched, or a TV show, or a commercial.
Correct. Absolutely.
Something like that. So in listening to that rendition of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, we are hearing many instruments. And of course, I have seen you conduct Orchestra Iowa, and you have many musicians all playing together. But that's also not necessarily part of the definition of classical music, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because there can be solo piano, there can be solo instruments by themselves, or there can be something that we call chamber music, which is a handful of people, let's say anywhere from 2 to 13 musicians playing together. Chamber literally means a room, and you have to remember, we are lucky in this day and age that we have all this technology. We can listen to music on the radio, or we can download it from iTunes or Spotify or what have you, but until the 1920s, if you wanted to listen to music, you would either have to go to a concert or you would have to make it yourself. And so 100 or so more years ago, a lot of people were playing music in their homes, and that's literally what chamber music is. So that could actually be any acoustic instrument of 1 to, let's say, 13 musicians.
With listening to a symphony orchestra play,
yeah.
Can you, for people who've never seen one, describe what it is?
Well, a symphony orchestra is usually an ensemble of, let's say, 20 or more people. Because depending on the style, Baroque music usually requires a smaller ensemble of mostly string players. And then you get into a later period where the orchestra gets larger with more instruments in the family, like adding woodwinds and brass. And by the time you get to the early 1900s, you're talking about an orchestra that could be 100 people strong on stage.
And I think a lot of kids, of course, pick up a stringed instrument when they're young, or are encouraged to pick up a stringed instrument when they're young, and they join orchestra maybe when they're in fourth or fifth grade, and they are playing in a group that is entirely string instruments. And that's not what we see with professional groups very often.
That is true. Now we're actually getting into the nitty-gritty of what does classical mean to the people of in the inside baseball of things, because throughout history there are eras of music that have a particular style and a particular instrumentation. For example, the Baroque, which scholars will disagree on this, but I think for the layperson, basically 1650 to 1750, you're looking at it at orchestras that are basically just string orchestras with maybe an organ or a harpsichord and maybe an oboe or a bassoon every once in a while, but basically it's just string music. And then we get to an era, the classical age. And this is why this term classical can be so confusing, because this is the more specific definition of the word. Generally, and again, scholars will disagree with me on this, but generally speaking, from 1740 to about 1810 or so, is the classical era or the age of music that spawned great composers like Beethoven, Haydn, and Mozart. And so that's basically a slightly larger string section with the addition of woodwinds like the clarinet, flutes, an oboe and bassoon, and occasionally an interloper like the trumpet might appear.
I wish that we had a visual medium here, because I think it would be great to illustrate these periods in music with some of the very funny collars and hats and wigs.
That's right.
That would have been worn during this time. But
I can't imagine why anybody would have thought a powdered wig was cool or fashionable. But you have to realize back then, I don't know why, but they would be wearing these things for almost 100 years. And so when you see pictures of Mozart or Haydn or Bach, they're wearing these ridiculous wigs.
All right. Well, we have some Mozart to play, but we're not going to do that yet, because we're going to take a short break first, and then we're going to get to Mozart. And would you define Mozart as maybe the original rock star, or at least he had to be one of them?
Certainly one of the earliest ones. Sure, Mozart was definitely sort of the rock star of age, of his age. Maybe Handel earlier, but not really. I think you're onto something. I think Mozart was really the great first rock star of his age.
All right, we will be back in just a moment. With
Excellent.
Me this hour, Tim Hankowitz. He is the director of Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids, and he is our camp counselor for the day. Talk of Iowa Summer Camp today. It's Classical Music Camp. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every Tuesday, all summer long, it's Talk of Iowa Summer Camp. And this hour, Classical Music Camp. With me, Tim Hankowitz, better known as the director of Orchestra Iowa. I was going to say camp counselor Tim Hankowitz, better known as the director of Orchestra Iowa. So, Tim, just before the break, we talked, and we're going to listen to some Mozart here. And
right.
We talked about him being maybe one of the first, one of the OG rock stars, really.
Yeah.
And you were talking about those powdered wigs. And I think Mozart and some of his contemporaries had something in common with a lot of kids this summer, which is that they didn't bathe very often. Maybe that has...
Oh my God, you are so right. In fact, Beethoven, who is just a little older than Mozart, he got kicked out of so many of his apartments because, frankly, he stank. And every once in a while, when he thought he needed to bathe, he would get a bucket of water and just pour it over his head. And all that water would seep through the floor onto his neighbors beneath him, and that caused a whole lot of trouble. So he could hardly keep a place to stay every 4 months or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess he was maybe too busy being a genius to take care of some basic hygiene. I don't know what certain young men in my household's excuse is this summer, but all right. So let's talk a little bit about Mozart before we listen, because I think I don't know, maybe Mozart is the artist that is most recognizable universally worldwide.
Yeah, I think that's a good assumption. Yep. And I think a lot of people who are interested in classical music in the broader sense of just orchestral or music that's been written down. Mozart is very easily accessible, but a lot of people, when they go to their first concert, are always scratching their heads, because in many ways you have to listen to classical music differently from the music that you listen to every day in Top 40.
When we listen to Mozart,
right,
what should we be listening for?
Well, when you listen to music today, most popular music is around 3 minutes long. And it has lyrics to that that you can understand and you can relate to. And sometimes there's also a strong beat or something catchy for you to grab your imagination, sort of like an earworm, we call them. And so it's pretty easily to understand. So when you're thrown into this universe where most classical pieces are like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and my goodness, can go up to 3 hours or 4 hours if you're talking about opera, people are going, my goodness, how can anybody wrap their minds around that? And the reason is, in classical music, you have to listen to it as though it were an essay. Because what a composer is going to do, and in fact, remember earlier when you played Beethoven's Fifth Symphony?
Yes.
Well, one of the great miracles of that symphony, it's about 30 minutes long, and the entire 30 minutes is developed from a simple idea, four notes, ba 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 ba. It's either in the accompaniment, it's or in the longer melodies. Basically, in that case, Beethoven was saying, here is an idea, four notes, look what I can do with it. And like any great essay, a composer is going to give you an idea and then elaborate on it and say, I can do this, I can redo the harmony, or I can play it faster or slower, or I can put it in combination with another melody, I can put it in the accompaniment, or I can, like a piece of Lego, break it up into smaller bits and put a microscope on a particular element and develop that. And so when you're listening to classical music, my advice is to listen to the very opening, and they're going to give you the raw material. And as the piece gets longer and longer, they're going to take that raw material and display it in very clever ways just to show off as what a composer can do. So I know that you have some Mozart queued up. And what Mozart's going to do, this is going to be the first movement of the Haffner Symphony, number 35. And you're going to hear bum, bum, ba-dum, bum. And you're going to hear that over and over and over and over, sometimes in the accompaniment, sometimes in the melody, and then sometimes just fragments of it. So when you're listening to this actually quite short movement by Mozart, think of it as an essay where he presents the main idea and then starts showing off to tell you what he can do with that idea.
All right, let's listen to just a little bit of it.
Sure.
So that's just a taste of Mozart's Symphony No. 35, the Haffner Symphony. That's the first movement. And we heard that theme repeating in different ways. But let's talk about movements, because you said to think about this composition like an essay. It's a really long essay with a lot of different parts.
It's more than an essay. In fact, it's a book. And it's when you hear the word movements, That confuses a lot of people. When they go into the concert hall, they are terrified of knowing when are you supposed to applaud.
Right, which I have questions about that, because when we listen to rock music, live music, we clap at the end of every song. When we listen to jazz music live, we clap whenever anybody does something cool. And then,
I know.
And then with classical, we're supposed to wait.
Like, what are we doing? Yeah, I know. And I miss those days, because a long time ago, in Mozart's time, they used to clap between movements all the time. And in fact, the same thing with jazz. If the artist did something really cool, it would delight the audience. And I miss those days. And there's a lot of reasons why it changed over the years. But I miss those days. And in fact, I encourage people to applaud whenever they feel like it in our concerts. But here's the deal. When you go to a concert, a classical music concert, the first thing you should do is open up the program and see what's being played. And you'll see, in this case, Mozart Haffner Symphony No. 3, and then it'll give you a list of four movements. That means don't clap between the movements, because think of movements as chapters in a book, and each chapter is an essay. If we were to go back to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that ba-ba-ba-ba, in later movements, in the second and third movements, that motive, that simple four-note rhythmic motive keeps on showing up. And so the composer's not done with his or her ideas yet. And so this is where it gets really confusing about what do I do with movements. Well, all you have to do is think of movements as chapters in a book, and because the composer hasn't finished their train of thought yet.
Is the silence that now exists in these performances, is that part of the music?
Sometimes it is. Obviously, between movements, people, you know, are retooling, getting ready for the next idea to be presented. But sometimes, during the performance, you know, the music will wash over you, and then all of a sudden the orchestra will stop and pause. And the silence is as important as the sound, because silence can also be used as a dramatic tool. In fact, when you go to the theater, for example, and you hear a great Shakespearean monologue, you know, after you've been shouted at by the actor, the pause of silence can be deafening. It can ring in your ears, and that is a very dramatic moment too. And that happens in music all the time.
So just at this moment where we can't have live music, just the sound of the concert hall with the rustling of the programs and the
right.
The musicians moving the papers on their stands and little clicks and clangs, that feels musical too.
And it's such a human endeavor, because, I mean, these pieces have been played for 200, 300, sometimes 400 years, but because this is a human endeavor, each performance is different from the next. So even if you're a real fan of Mozart or whatever piece and you go hear it in a live performance, it will always be somewhat different than the recording you're used to or someone else's performance. And that's the beauty of live performance.
Listening to that piece of Mozart's and listening for that theme to repeat, there are so many other things going on there. And when you listen to classical music, can you fall into maybe a little bit of a pitfall of listening too hard and getting in the way of feeling the music?
Yes, you can. But I always equate classical music a lot like baseball. So I love going out to the ballpark on a beautiful day, eating some popcorn and a couple hot dogs, and I enjoy the game, which is about 3 hours long. But I do know classical music, like baseball, the more effort you put into it, the more you're going to enjoy it. Now, I know that if I knew the statistics of the players, if I knew the players themselves, the history, the inside sort of strategy of how that the game works, my enjoyment of the game will go through the roof, and it's the same with classical music. Because I've been listening to this music, Beethoven's Fifth, for the last 30, 40 years, and I'm still hearing new things about it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So when you listen to the same piece over and over again, you're going to learn more about it. But also, if you know the composer's canon, do you start to hear echoes of things that they've done in other pieces and signature pieces and maybe even jokes?
Absolutely. Everybody has their tell. Whether you're a poker player or whether you're a composer. I mean, there are certain things and ideas and sounds that keep on reappearing. But here's the magic. I mean, when you hear three notes of Mozart, you know it's Mozart. If you hear three notes, well, if you hear the first chord of Benny and the Jets of Elton John, you know what piece that is. It is the sign of a genius is someone who creates something great and yet is instantly recognizable as that person's personality.
And there is feeling, though. I mean, you get you have an emotional reaction to the music. That's part of the composer and the musicians who are performing. That's part of their goal, is to make you feel something too, right?
You're absolutely right. I think all music, and especially classical music in the broadest sense, is all about translating emotion to sound. I pointed out how to listen to the music like as though it were an essay, and that's a very intellectual exercise. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't impart something emotionally to you, it either the piece isn't successful or the performance wasn't successful. Because art carries the gamut of all emotion, whether it's joy, whether it's sorrow, whether it's love, whether it's hate. And that is why music is such a powerful medium, because it can really express what words really can't nail down.
We have listened to Beethoven and Mozart so far, and both of the pieces that we listened to are very pleasing, very beautiful. And classical music doesn't always carry that beautiful, lovely sound. Although I think that that's an entry, maybe a gateway for a lot of people.
Right.
I certainly hear classical pieces that feel uncomfortable to me.
Right, right.
Why do I want to listen to those?
Well, I mean, art is meant to provoke. And remember, by the time we get to Beethoven and beyond, composers see themselves as artists and advocates for social justice in a variety of ways. And so sometimes music is intended to make people uncomfortable, to write about war and its aftermath, to write about racial injustice. That's been done as well. I mean, these are subjects that aren't necessarily comfortable, and so the music that is inspired by such topics aren't intended to be soothing.
Let's play with a theme that I think a lot of people are extremely familiar with. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
So earlier I said you should listen to how the composer develops an idea, like an essay. And there are so many ways of doing it. One is repetition. But another way is taking something that is very familiar, the common experience that people can recognize, and then show off what they can do with that theme. We call that a theme and variation sometimes. They can either keep the melody and change the harmony, or alter slightly the melody and keep the harmony, or they can play it fast, or they can play it slowly, or again, they can just concentrate on a very small, maybe like with a microscope, a very small rhythmic component of it, and turn it into something unbelievable. And so I think this next piece that we have will demonstrate that pretty well.
All right, let's listen. Obviously, there is a great deal more that we can do with Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star there,
yeah.
But it becomes truly extraordinary.
who would have thought that's possible? And a great composer can go on and on and on and on, and yet the basic source material can be so simple.
And is that another Mozart piece?
Well, that's, Twinkle Twinkle has been around for a long time. I know that Mozart has said a bunch of variations on it. I don't think that's his piece directly.
All right.
I just think it's one of those songs that's been in sort of the consciousness for hundreds of years.
All right. So that's a little bit of apocryphal trivia that we like to,
right,
to share. But
right.
Tim, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Classical Music Camp today on Talk of Iowa. Every Tuesday all summer long, it's Talk of Iowa Summer Camp. And today our camp counselor is Tim Pankowicz. He is the director of Orchestra Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa Summer Camp today. It's Classical Music Camp with Camp Counselor Tim Pankowicz. He is also the director of Orchestra Iowa when he's not a camp counselor. And Tim, when did you first get into classical music? What got you hooked?
I got into classical music quite young, when I was around 5 years old. There was lots of music going on in the household. Both my parents were amateur musicians, and we got involved in the community a lot with live performance. But like so many others, I grew up in an era where I only had one television station, maybe two or three, and I loved those classic Bugs Bunny cartoons. Classic. There's that word again. All these great cartoons that, again, predate me. I may be old, but I'm not that old. But there are some great episodes that featured classical music. And they were produced and created, these cartoons, at a time where classical music was still a little bit more mainstream in people's consciousness. And so a lot of the humor in those videos and on those cartoons are really, really quite profound.
Did you start playing an instrument young?
I did. I remember my earliest memories are sitting on my mom's lap, playing through pieces that she learned as a girl, through her music books. And that's my earliest memories of learning how to play the piano. Yeah.
What made you want to become a director?
Oh, you know, I think it chose me than the other way around. I never really had an ambition growing up early to say, I'm going to become a conductor. I really thought I was going to be a pianist. To this day, I always joke that I'm a recovering pianist. And in college, all my friends were playing in orchestras, and I was starting to hang around with them, and I started hanging around with the conductor a bit, who started throwing work my way, and just slowly over time, I realized I was conducting more than I was playing, and I think the world is a better place because of it.
Now, when we see classical music,
I meant that because my piano skills leave much to be desired today.
Well, I have no evidence to the contrary or to support your theory. I'm sure you're wrong. But so when we watch a classical music performance, when we go see Orchestra Iowa or any of, right, the other great symphonies in the state, we do see the director standing up on stage and waving, right, the baton around and really throwing, at least when you conduct, your whole body into, right, into what you're doing. What are you doing other than keeping time?
I think many musicians would ask the same question, but in many ways, the conductor is the focal point for everyone to direct their sound. And at the same time, with the basic gesture, what the conductor is doing by just giving the beat, they are giving the framework for everyone else to execute their part in context with each other, because sound moves remarkably slowly. And so if you're separated by 30 feet, there is also a time lag. So as you're playing your part, you're hearing how it fits in with everybody else's part, but you're also seeing the beat up front so that you know that you are playing together with everyone else. That's the very basics. And what conductors do more, it's kind of like advanced mime, in which we give people their cues, because if you're waiting 300 measures before you have that one cymbal crash, you really want to make sure you're going to do it at the right time. And so when you look at the conductor and the conductor gives you that sort of courage to play. You're eliminating doubt for people to actually execute their part. And then finally, by the way you gesture, you can show them whether to play louder or play softer or how to shape a particular phrase. And so in many ways, all that movement on stage ultimately translates into how the musicians are performing.
I have never thought about the fact that you are the focal point for that sound. So you really have the best seat in the house. That is the place where all of that music comes together.
I will not argue with you there. It is a spectacular place to be, and I'm not going to lie. It is. There are times in concerts where I just, not only is it the best seat in the house, it's the best job in the world.
You mentioned the Bugs Bunny Looney Tunes cartoons earlier, and of course, a lot of people were introduced to classical music through those cartoons, and probably that still happens to a degree. But we also hear classical music all over the place. So even if we don't think we're classical music fans, or we don't listen to classical music in our homes, we are hearing it, right?
So this is funny. I've noticed recently in the past few years, and there's a reason for it, we can get into this, that on commercials and even television series, I've been hearing classical music in the background or sometimes as its theme song. What happened fairly recently, within the last 5 years, copyright law has changed. So if you're producing a television series, hiring somebody to write a jingle for your television show is very expensive. And every time that television show is broadcast, that composer and or musicians are getting paid. And so it's very expensive to actually create a jingle or a theme song for your television show. So all of a sudden, a lot of television shows are starting to use, and commercials are starting to use, classical music in the background.
Because
it's cheap, and it is no longer subject to copyright law because it's so old. And so I'm finding it's really, really quite odd, this resurgence in classical music in pop culture that's happening on television as we speak.
You have an example for us?
Yeah, one of my favorite sitcoms is something called Mom. I think it's in its sixth season now. And the opening credits is Glinka's overture to Ruslana Ludmilla, which was written in like 1840 or something like that.
All right, let's listen. So now when people who watch CBS in the future go to concerts where that's performed, they'll be like, oh, I know that
right.
one.
That's, I know that
that's
one.
The theme
yes.
song to Mom.
Yeah.
So we do hear classical music like that all over the place, but we also hear new compositions that would be defined as classical that are used in popular culture as well, right?
Certainly. I think John Williams is one of the greatest composers to ever have lived. And one thing that we've really never touched on in this hour is something called style. Over the last 400 years plus, I mean, there's a lot of music, and each generation has its own sound and style, the classical style versus the romantic versus the baroque. We don't need to get into that. But when movies or television or some of these epics on Netflix and even video games, when they want this huge canvas, this huge epic grandeur in the soundtrack, they hire composers to write these huge symphonic soundtracks. And these composers now have all these stylistic options to plug into the music to fit the dramatic moments at hand. And John Williams is a master of that. My goodness. One of the first pieces that ever turned me on to classical music, as so many others, was his classic, there's that word again, score to Star Wars. And yet people in the know realize that John Williams was modeling his music after a bunch of other composers who lived hundreds of years before him, like Richard Strauss and others. But what John Williams' greatest genius is he's a stylistic chameleon, and he knows how to draw upon all these techniques to such wonderful effect.
Well, and for people who maybe have heard this music and don't know that it's John Williams, I know that's hard for you to imagine, Tim, but
right?
there are probably a few of us out there. So Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Harry Potter films. If you love a theme, it's probably John Williams.
You know, everything that he writes seems to be a hit. Jurassic Park, of course. Jaws, that's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. E.T., I mean, it goes on and on and on. Any composer would be lucky to even have half his output. And everything he writes is just red-letter great stuff.
So,
and musicians love to play it, too.
Oh, I can only imagine. I love to listen.
Yeah.
It must be that much fun to perform it as well, especially with a huge orchestra. So you wanted to play one of the older classical pieces that was an inspiration for him, right?
Certainly. This is actually a good way to demonstrate how John Williams is able to identify the right style and emulate it into his own music. So one of the great classic pieces, there's that word again, that people love in the concert hall is a piece called The Planets by Gustav Holst. And the first movement, the first chapter in that long book, is a work called Mars, Bringer of War. And eventually, it's this music that he inserts later on, John Williams, that is, in his Star Wars score.
All right, let's listen. That's just a little bit of Mars from The Planets by Holst. And, of course, if we listen to the whole piece, we'll get even more of those elements that John Williams quotes. But I can imagine Darth Vader sweeping around to that for sure.
Absolutely. In fact, when you hear the Imperial Forces theme that comes in the main title of Star Wars, it is almost lifted note for note from that. And, it's not that John Williams was necessarily copying. He was emulating, and he was using that particular style to perfect effect in his films.
All right. So also, we hear that technique echoed in hip-hop and rap music with the sampling that is done
sampling,
in that.
Sampling and quotation, you are absolutely right. You know, there is nothing new under the sky. I always think that the nature of creativity is to take someone else's idea or some sort of mundane element that's in front of everybody's eyes and transforming it into something new and expressive. And quoting and borrowing from other people musically, composers have been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Why should we spend some time getting to know classical music? I mean, we've listened to some great pieces this hour. Obviously, there's a whole world there to explore. But what do you really feel it does to enhance our lives and our understanding of the world around us to dig into this kind of music?
Well, I think it's food for the soul. You know, the emotional gamut is so broad, and yet sometimes a lot of the music that we listen to in the background on a day-to-day basis is so narrow. Classical music is one that allows you to retouch, get in touch with your soul and your emotions once again. And also in a world that seems to be so fast these days, although things have been slowing down because of the pandemic, to force people to slow down and reflect on their lives, on what's going on, and also to spend time almost meditatively with themselves. That's where classical music comes in. And again, it's this search of how the composer is putting these musical elements together in relationships with each other is what defines the strength of, and its emotional content defines the strength of classical music. It really is about being in touch with what's important in your life, and that takes time and it takes reflection.
If someone is now thinking about some of the soundtracks, some of the music that they hear when they're right. watching a movie, I mean, that sounds like a wonderful opportunity to really pay attention to what the music is doing. It really showcases right. the, I guess, the emotion that can be...
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because if you were to see a love theme, a love scene in a film without the music, it's very two-dimensional. But once you put the soundtrack underneath it, that dialogue now becomes emotionally charged. And a simple dialogue with a simple dialogue, depending on the flavor of the music, can express love, it can express tension, hate, envy. All that emotional information is provided not by the script, but by the music underneath.
Where do you suggest someone start with classical music?
Oh, with classical music, start small. I think one thing that discourages people, that some of these symphonies can go on for 30, 40, 50 minutes or so. You know, I think Mozart is sort of the ideal entrance. Everything he writes is so gorgeous and so beautiful and easily accessible and not too long. And in fact, it's okay if you listen to just one movement of the symphony rather than all four or five or how many there are in there. But just to listen to it in small increments and listen to it over and over and over. And especially if you want to go to a live performance of a symphony, listen to the music ahead of time before the live concert and listen to it several times so that when you hear it in live performance, you can compare it with what you're used to. And then you'll realize how great an experience live performance can be.
Oh, well, Tim Hankowicz, thank you so much for being here today. And we're going to go out with the great John Williams and the theme from Star Wars. And Tim, I hope you're doing well. I know it must be a difficult time to be in live music without an opportunity to perform.
There can be no music without an audience, without a doubt. But I want to thank you for putting up with me, and may the force be with you. May the force be with us all.
Tim Hankowicz, thank you so much. Tim Hankowicz is the director of Orchestra Iowa. You've been listening to Talk of Iowa Summer Camp today, Classical Music Camp. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.